Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with my former student, David Levinson, who is now Dr. David Levinson, currently the inaugural presidential fellow for the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities. Before this, Dr. Levinson served as president of Norwalk Community College, NCC, in Norwalk, Connecticut, for 15 years. During his presidency, NCC was selected as one of only three community colleges in the nation to lead a science, technology, engineering, and mathematics STEM regional collaborative with the funding assistance from the Leona M. and Harry M. Helmsley Charitable Trust. In partnership with IBM and the Norwalk Public Schools, NCC created the Norwalk Early College Academy, NECA, modeled after the Pathways to Technology Early College High School, PTEC, in Brooklyn, New York. Dr. Levinson is also the general editor of Education and Sociology, an encyclopedia, and author of Community Colleges, a Reference Handbook. His articles and reviews have appeared in the American Prospect, the American Sociologist, Community College Journal of Research and Practice, Community College Week, American Journal of Sociology, and Contemporary Sociology. Dr. Levinson served on the New England Association of Schools and Colleges, NEASC, Commission on Institutions of Higher Education. He was awarded the New England Board of Higher Education Connecticut Higher Education Excellence and Award in 2018, the recipient of a Distinguished Teaching Award from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Dr. Levinson holds a BA in Sociology from the State University of New York at New Paltz and an MA and PhD in Sociology from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. We'll talk with Dr. David Levinson about all of that and much more. But first, welcome, David Levinson.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's my pleasure and honor to be here.
Well, you know, you wrote me a really nice note, and you said you remembered my class. What do you remember about me? Was I a wise guy or what?
A little bit wise guy. I remember, I think you had a beard.
I did.
And, you know, you sound very similar. I haven't heard your voice for many years. But what I really enjoyed about your class is that I remember the excitement that you exuded in terms of politics at the time, and certainly in the fall of 1971, it was quite an active time nationally and also at New Paltz.
Wow, yeah, it was. And I have been retired from the university for a while, but I have to tell you how much I love New Paltz. I love the whole way it was. I love the way it is. People come from all over to go there. When 1971, not as much as now, but right now, it's very hard to get into. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I love visiting New Paltz, and you're right. The traffic down Main Street is foreboding, and seeing the university flourish has also been wonderful. And, you know, seeing some of my older or my former professors and also the new folks that have taken over, it's very enchanting is how I would describe it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There are some colleges and universities where people never leave. I mean, there are people who stay forever. So, yeah. And New Paltz is one of those places, 90 miles from New York, equal distance from Albany, and a sort of what's left over, I hate to say this, of a hippieistic culture.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And, you know, I have sort of a dear professor, Erwin Sperber, who is still on the faculty, and someone who I've seen a number of times, Jerry Benjamin, even though I never had any classes with Professor Benjamin. I've seen him in various different venues, and the institute that I believe is named after him, I believe, is still thriving at New Paltz. And, you know, and then for me, you know, as a sociology major, in touch with the current generation of sociologists at SUNY New Paltz and have been a guest lecturer in some of their classes and see them at meetings. So the continuity for close to 50 years, I just find remarkable and just so comforting and nurturing. So it's a beautiful connection.
So how old are you now, David Levinson?
Yeah, I just turned 65.
Sheesh, how did that happen?
I don't know. And also was rudely introduced to the wonderful world of Medicare and what you need to do for health benefits. And all I can say, I don't know if it's the state of Connecticut or the nation, it's not easy to retire.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
So let's start. You were born where? Where did you live?
Yeah, I was born in Jackson Heights, Queens, in a two-bedroom, small rent-controlled apartment. And as I love to tell people, at the age of 9, I would hop on the elevated 7 line and either go to Shea Stadium or the New York World's Fair in 1964. And unfortunately, I remain a Mets fan to this very day and was recently at Citi Field just a week ago.
I can't help but ask you, because we have a guy, Ray Graff, who works here. Yeah. He's a fabulous Mets fan. And every year he tells me in the beginning of the year, this is the year. And then?
Then major disappointment, and they have fulfilled that very expectation this year. You know, they had some good periods and bad periods and then made a run for it after the All-Star break. And I think last night the loss to the Marlins was unfortunately the proverbial nail in the coffin.
As we speak.
Yeah.
David Levinson, I guess the question is, you're a sociologist, not a political scientist. And sociologists, of course, especially at New Paltz, was always a little bit to the left of center.
Yeah.
Would you admit to that?
Oh, yeah. That was my attraction to sociology at New Paltz. New Paltz, you know, I remember Aaron Bidman, who
I guess
was at one point a card-carrying communist.
And a sculptor of note.
Yeah, a sculptor, yes, yes. And died fairly recently, in his mid-90s, I believe.
Wow.
But, you know, a lot of the faculty at New Paltz seemed to migrate from the University of California, Berkeley, where grad students there is part of the free speech movement. So, you know, I had classes on such great topics like a whole course on Bob Dylan, political strategies, you name it.
Great.
And it was a wonderful education. The only problem I had is when I then applied to graduate school and I took a year off, then went back to grad school and took my GREs in sociology. The sad part is my GRE score showed that I knew nothing of mainstream American sociology.
Right, because the department was so left. Is that what you're saying?
It was so left. And, you know, then when I was admitted to the University of Massachusetts Amherst in sociology, and later on when the Freedom of Information Act, at least in Massachusetts, was passed, this is probably about 1978, I remember looking into my file and seeing that I was classified as a high-risk student because I basically had no sociology background. It was pretty funny. And then also the other challenge I had was going from a place like New Paltz to, at that point, UMass Amherst, which had a reputation for a lot of left-leaning folks, but there were none in the sociology department.
Interesting. So quite the opposite of New Paltz.
Totally opposite. You know, and I really wondered, was sociology for me, because it was a very different reality there. But sure enough, it all worked out, and I got my 2 degrees from UMass Amherst. But the irony was, sociology at that point was very well respected at UMass, had some nationally known professors, but none who were leftists. And what was helpful for me at that period of time is that we were literally, as a department, sandwiched between the economics department that had a lot of radical economists and political science. And so the graduate students all reflected more of the leftist persuasion. So I did feel at home, but in a different way than what I felt like at New Paltz.
I love New Paltz, as I have already said. However, that sociology department did have a sort of political criteria for employment, as I remember it, down in the time. And I had to go to bat for one of the professors, who was at some risk because she was not leftist enough. So that's always a risk, right? In these departments, they get taken over by one group or another. And I guess that includes political science and everybody else.
That is risky, and I find very problematic now that I'm a ripe old 65-year-old. I've come to
conclude that's not fair. That's not right. Yeah, go ahead.
But in my own work now, I feel it's so important to have a diversity of perspectives. And one thing I stress in my teaching and actually my evaluations of faculty is they need to be teaching students to think critically, not to think one way or the other. So actually at New Paltz, in many ways, although, you know, I had a wonderful time and enjoyed it, if I were president of New Paltz at this juncture, which I know has changed, but if I was president with the same faculty, I would not be happy because I would feel our students were just getting one perspective and only one.
Well, I know the contemporary president of New Paltz. He's a wonderful man. And they've had a series of very wonderful presidents at New Paltz over the years. It's been amazing. And I think that's one of the criteria. You're a college president. How much does a college president count in terms of the character of a university?
I think it counts a lot. And, you know, going back to the New Paul's president, Stanley Kaufman, who unfortunately has now passed, was a president then.
And but, tenured you know, me.
Okay, great. Yeah. Hey, good. I have to say I was one who would protest Stanley Kaufman because I was also a self-proclaimed student radical at the time. But in years since, have gotten to know Alice Chandler. Her husband, Horace, was a faculty member at Bergen Community College where
I worked. Oh, interesting.
And also Roger Bowen. Roger became a friend of mine because when I was president at NAR Community College, one of the things that I did in my first year there was to revamp the governance structure and to make it much more, I thought, egalitarian so I could hear the voices of all. And Roger, at that point, was Secretary General of the AAUP.
Wow, and I remember that.
And I didn't know Roger. I knew of him and invited him to the campus because I wanted him to talk about governance. And due to that, we've struck up a friendship. So, and now Donald Christensen, I know Don and met him a number of times.
A wonderful man.
Yeah, wonderful. And it's like, you know, I was saying before, Alan, the continuity of New Paul's in so many ways still touches me. And as a now former college president, to have those presidents as role models has also been so enriching.
Were your parents lefties?
No, they weren't. My mother was a school teacher in the New York City public schools. My father worked for the federal government. He was a personnel officer for the Federal Aviation Agency. So they were, I would say, liberal, but certainly not lefties by any means.
Yeah. Did that cause you any problems? I mean, I was in the same demographic that you are. My parents were liberals. Mm-hmm. And frankly, people on the left, the serious left, were not happy with liberals at the time. Did you feel any of that?
Yeah, well, what I felt is my parents, my mother especially, was concerned I was going to be expelled from New Paul's for writing nasty things about the administration. I had a column
for the Oracle
called Beneath the Surface or something like that, where I would ridicule the administration on a weekly basis. And then I became editor of the Oracle. And I'm not sure I'm so proud of this now, but really turned it into a leftist publication. And my mother was assured that I was going to be thrown out. And one of the things I remember of New Paul's was President Kaufman, to his credit, invited me to a reception for distinguished students. And he delivered one of the greatest lines. I remember shaking his hand. He said, "David, it's so nice to see you under social circumstances."
I love that guy. I loved him. He was a wonderful
man. Just delivered it beautifully. And again, just in that, you know, sent a message that, you know, again, I recollect, oh my goodness, you know, more than 40 years after my graduation at New Paul's.
Wow. So your parents were liberals, but not lefties.
Not at all.
And you took your own path, and you took a political science course with me, but you ended up with sociology, which was further left, at least in our campus. So why?
Well, what ended up happening is, you know, this is a good story. When I enrolled in New Paul's, I indicated I wanted to be a psychology major, and those were the days that you had to go, I think it was the Elting Gymnasium for registration, and it was a very hand-driven process with enrollment cards. And I remember going to the psychology department and trying to get an intro to psych class, and they were all filled. And I said, "Well, I'm a psychology major," and they had no empathy at all. They said tough noogies, and right next to psychology was sociology. And I needed a class. So I moved literally to my right, not knowing I was moving to the left, right? And I ended up enrolling in Intro to Sociology with Ken Skelton at the time. Mm-hmm. And that's when my eyes were opened. I was a fairly conservative person at that juncture. I was not a leftist by any means. But I remember taking this course with Ken Skelton. It was an LC100 with 300 students. And Ken was a very slight man with a very refined accent. And the term that I remember throughout the course he would use is "those capitalist bastards." And he had us reading stuff from G. William Domhoff, Higher Circles. And it really, at that time, opened my eyes. So that created my pathway to be a sociology major. Though the other interest I had in New Paul's was mathematics. My other aspiration became I wanted to be a secondary school math teacher. I loved math. And I took a few semesters of calculus, decided I didn't really love math, and then the person who talked me out of being a math major was Erwin Sperber, who said, "You'll never survive teaching math in a secondary school." And Erwin was the person who also convinced me with where I was going at the time to become a sociology major. And so that's how I became a sociologist, and that's how I became a leftist. And again, the program at New Paltz at the time really nurtured my leftist inklings.
What did you write your dissertation on?
My dissertation was a study of then the Massachusetts High Technology Council in the mid-1980s and how it was impacting on higher education policy in the state. And that was a time where Michael Dukakis was governing what was euphemistically called the Massachusetts Miracle, and around the time that he emerged as a presidential candidate. So I was very interested in, you know, the role of private industry, the role of a group that I termed neoliberals and how they were impacting on the state. And ironically, the current governor of Massachusetts, Charlie Baker, was one of the principals, a very young Charlie Baker, involved in the Mass High Tech Council. So I never interviewed him, but I use a lot of his writings as part of my dissertation.
Interesting. You know, I had, it's probably off topic, a thing with Mike Dukakis. Dukakis people decided, since I was interviewing Mario Cuomo for many, many years, every week, that they wanted to try it. So I had him on, and he was terrible. Just awful. What happened was that, you know, I asked him a question, and he would say no or yes. Whereas if I asked Mario Cuomo a question, you know, we're off to the races. Forget it.
Right.
How are you, Governor? And that would be it. So I meet him at a cocktail party years later. And I said, "I know you. You know, I interviewed you on the radio. How was I?" He says. I said, "You stunk." And, and he said, yeah. "What?" I said, "Well, come on. You know, I asked you 132 questions, which you were answered yes or no." Whereas used to Mario, you know, you would just say, "How are you, Governor?" And then you wouldn't have to ask another question. So he yelled across the room to Kitty. He said, "Kitty, this guy interviewed me and says I stunk." So it's interesting. Now, your perspective going into this dissertation was obviously leftist. And
yeah,
this was not that much keeping with your philosophical norms, right?
Right. No, it was interesting. And in many ways, my dissertation disproved my theory at the time. I was thinking that, you know, there would be a one-to-one correspondence, whatever the High Tech Council wanted would be rendered into higher ed policy, and that wasn't the case. It was much more pluralistic, and I did an interview. I had a sample of a number of public and private colleges and universities. So it actually opened my eyes that the world is far more complex than what I was believing, certainly coming out of SUNY New Paltz in sociology.
So let's take up the story. You get out, you teach at UMass as an assistant, or what happens then?
Yeah, I was a teaching assistant at UMass and then taught also in other areas. I was a rhetoric instructor at that point. UMass faculty in English had no desire to teach what was really intro to English, but they called it rhetoric. And ironically, the graduate students in all different disciplines had assistantships. And the one I had for that year was, I think, 80 to 81 was in rhetoric. So I taught rhetoric, for which I actually got the Distinguished Teaching Award. Not that I knew anything about how to teach rhetoric.
They obviously knew a good, exciting teacher when they saw one.
Yeah, no, I was very, very flattered. And so I stayed there for a number of years doing odds and ends, you know, teaching, and at one point started on one dissertation and then lost interest and took a leave of absence. And I moved then to Boston area where I actually met my wife. I was working at that time doing some consulting work for friends who oversaw the process of certifying cable TV franchises. And they were doing a lot of survey work in various communities that I was working on. And I was living in Boston, though had no real roots in the city, and decided to volunteer as a tutor in the Boston public schools. And I was assigned to the woman who has become my wife for 33 years to her classroom. So that was wonderful. And then stayed on, started teaching at Merrimack College in North Andover. And I taught there full time as I was finishing my dissertation, and then was on their faculty for altogether, I think it was 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
So taught there and then migrated to the community college world, Massachusetts Bay Community College, which was very close to my house. We lived in Weston, Weston, Massachusetts, and started teaching at the community college. And even though I had never set foot in a community college in my life, I found the students there so enthralling because sociology came alive. Those were the students that had these incredibly rich lived experiences.
We're talking today with Dr. David Levinson, the inaugural presidential fellow for the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities. Okay, so David, take us back. You're now teaching in a community college and you're in love with it.
Right. I'm teaching in a community college and just amazed by the students and just loving it. And then I was offered a position as a dean at Mass Bay Community College. And so I was doing a little bit of teaching and administration and eventually then went to Bergen Community College in Paramus, New Jersey.
How did that happen? Did you apply for a job or did they call you or how did it
I applied. You know, I'd been at Mass Bay for, I think it was like 6-7 years. I really wanted to, at that point, move up in the administrative world and applied to Bergen and was fortunate to be given the opportunity there. And Bergen was a, you know, really great institution. I enjoyed being an academic vice president. And then I got the presidential bug and went to a short wannabe president course that was given by then a group called the League for Innovation, the community colleges, and decided that I could be me and still be a college president, and went on the job market and was hired by Norwalk Community College and started there in August of 2004.
So let me stop you and ask you, now you're still married, right?
That's correct.
And your wife becomes the, quote, trailing spouse.
Right, which was a struggle because at that time, when I went to Bergen, she was still teaching in the Boston Public Schools. And so for 3 of the 4 years I was at Bergen, I commuted weekly from Paramus, New Jersey, back to the Boston area where we lived. And that was always a struggle, was trying to coordinate both of our careers together. And fortunately, when we then moved to Norwalk, she was able to be employed by the Norwalk Public Schools. But she didn't have the continuity that clearly would have been beneficial pension-wise from the city of Boston.
Yeah. Massachusetts is a funny state because, as you probably know all too well, Massachusetts was one of those inaugural states which decided not to adopt Social Security.
Right.
And as a result, everybody else has their pension plus Social Security, but not if you worked in Massachusetts.
Exactly. That's exactly our situation. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, my wife
and
has
mine.
Some social...
Oh,
really?
Oh, my wife. Wow. My wife taught in the Massachusetts schools, right?
Oh, okay.
Including Mass College of Liberal Arts. And, so, you know, you get a pension, but that's what happened.
Right.
So, okay, you're now a college president.
Yes, I was college president in August 2004. And the question you asked, to what extent does the leadership, the president of college, influence or structure its environment? And the thing I felt when I became president in our community college, that even though we were a community college, I was a little bit surprised that the college was somewhat isolated from various different aspects of the community. The college did have a great fundraising arm when I arrived, which was amazing, I thought, for a relatively small community college. But there weren't the connections to the community at large that I thought was very important. So that was probably the hallmark of my presidency, was reaching out to the community. We were designated by the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching as a community-engaged institution, created over 100 different partnerships with community-based agencies. And in many ways, because of that, I created with the then head of the NAACP in Norwalk and mayor and school superintendent a coalition called Norwalk Acts. That's a group of now still over 100 entities that are working together as a community to try to overcome the achievement gap and try to provide equal opportunities for all.
So how long were you there?
I was there for 15 years.
That's a long time.
Very long time for a college president.
Right. I think it's about twice the usual tenure. So
Yeah, no. And it was and continues to be a wonderful experience because in my current role as the presidential fellow for the state university system, I'm technically a retiree, a rehired retiree using Connecticut parlance. But one of the things I get to do is still stay involved with a number of the projects. And in fact, we've now created a separate 501c3. We hired an executive director. We are involved in really trying to increase the financial wherewithal of the organization and its effectiveness. So I still have a level of continuity. But on the other hand, you know, some of the everyday trials and tribulations I no longer have to deal with, which is actually very nice.
So, David Levinson, let's, if we can, talk about what you learned as a college president. I mean,
sure.
I've interviewed many, many college presidents over the years. And one of the first questions is relationships with faculty. That can't be that easy because everybody thinks they deserve more than they're getting. I don't only mean in terms of money, but in terms of prestige and promotion and everything else. How do you handle that?
Yeah, that was very challenging. I mean, the way I handled it is when I did get to know our community college, I was struck by the lack of any meaningful governance structure. And one of the things that I did was to create a task force that developed a college senate. And it was one of the things that I did not just to be chic as a new president, but I felt very strongly, having come from Bergen and also New Paltz, where faculty at least always had a loud voice.
Loud voice is right.
A loud voice, whether it got into policy, is always a different situation. But I really wanted to hear from faculty and staff. And so the first thing I did was to create this task force that developed a college senate. And to this very day, I'm very proud of that because it was a college senate, so it embraced all faculty and staff and probably about 35 members of a representative body. And it really created a voice that to me was always important, one that I often listened and adopted the Senate recommendations, but also, you know, had a few tense times where the Senate and I disagreed, but it was all done. I always felt respected for what I did. And even when I made decisions that weren't so popular, I tried to explain my thinking. And I felt, even though people disagreed with me, I felt respected by them. And so that was really, you know, one of the reasons that my longevity there was so wonderful.
So what were some of the decisions which weren't so popular?
One decision I made was, it came time to promote some faculty. There was a promotion process at the college where, you know, the president makes the final say, and there were promotion committees that would recommend candidates. And I remember, you know, times turning down the promotion committees. And the first year I was there, I remember I turned down, I think it was four faculty. And it became an issue because a certain group felt I was disrespecting faculty rights. So there was, I was only there for less than a year, and one of our union leaders began a vote of no confidence in me. And fortunately, that was stymied by by other faculty in the representative body that we created. But that was always a difficult situation when, you know, you turn down recommendations. And the difficulty at Norwalk, and still to this day, is that there were union-based promotion and tenure committees that made recommendations. And so there was a certain, I would say, inherent bias. And at that time, I felt the committee in that one union was not being as forthright as it should be. That was a difficult decision.
What does union-based mean?
Oh, union-based at Norwalk, there were two faculty unions, AFT chapter and also 4Cs, which was the Connecticut Community Colleges, a part of SEIU. And each union had its own promotion committee. So if you were in a given union, you went to that union-based committee and the union then made a recommendation on your application for promotion. Mm. And the year when I started, the union, the one union recommended everybody. And there were four people that I thought were not deserving. And that created some conflict, to say the least. And I was a new president at the time. And I didn't want, it wasn't for me a power trip. It was just that I felt there needs to be certain standards. And the people who were recommended did not meet those standards.
Well, you know, I've heard about this kind of thing before. Everybody wants to be promoted, obviously. But the criteria for a college president is, what have you achieved? What have you done? As opposed to, have you been in rank long enough so that you should automatically be promoted? And I think as colleges get better, the criteria goes up.
Oh, I think so. I mean, that was one of the things that I tried to instill. And at Norwalk, you know, the focus was really on teaching and service and certainly some scholarship, you know, not as great as a research-based university. And I tried to reward people with promotions who had demonstrated areas of effectiveness and, you know, was happy to provide whatever support financially and otherwise that I could. But again, you know, I felt for the good of the students, we needed to see, you know, a real achievement and accomplishment.
So who was supervising you when you were the president of Norwalk? In other words, who said he's doing a good job or not?
Yeah, at that point, there was a chancellor of the community college system. From 2004 to 2011, there was a separate community college system in Connecticut. So there was a chancellor to whom I reported, and he oversaw the 12 community colleges. And there was a board of trustees that actually oversaw the chancellor, but also indirectly was overseeing the presidents too.
Was there ever any conflict with your boss?
No, my boss was incredibly supportive because one of the things I did also, I was only there for a little over a month, and I felt I had to relieve my chief fiscal officer of his duties. I didn't feel that things were being shared with me, and he was a longtime employee. And I learned in wannabe president school, don't do anything without first telling your boss what you're going to do. And I remember calling my chancellor at the time, and he said, you do what you need to do. And when I discharged this individual, it created a real stir statewide because he was one of the senior people, CFOs amongst the others in the state of Connecticut. And there was a lot of pushback, but my chancellor really supported me. And ultimately, I know I made the right decision.
We are talking with Dr. David Levinson, who, as you can see, has come a long way since his time at New Paltz. Although at New Paltz, you were kind of distinguished, too, because, as you say, you were the editor of The Oracle, the distinguished newspaper of the place at the time.
No, that's correct. You know, that was a wonderful experience, being editor of The Oracle. Also, I was very involved. There was then a division of experimental studies, so I never created a class that I taught. It was an urban tutorial program in Kingston, New York, that I was able to convert into, I believe, it was 4 credits, and I was the instructor.
As a student?
As a student, yeah. That was
very New Paltz.
At
the time.
At the time, and I think I, when I looked at my transcript, I think about almost a quarter of my credits were through what was called experimental studies and, you know, sometimes questionable academic.
I remember it very well because I started a course called Law Society and the Legal Profession, and it was 15 credits. And we took everybody everywhere. You name it, we were there. And so that is so interesting. Now, when you wrote me the note that you did, you said, okay, you remember some stuff that I did.
Right.
That you adopted, for example, reaction papers. How much do you imbibe of what other people have done with you that becomes part of your character?
Oh, well, a lot. I mean, you know, with you, it was the reaction papers. I'm teaching in the higher ed leadership program at Johnson & Wales University in Rhode Island, a course in resource management and planning. So when I was putting together the syllabus, I decided what I wanted to do was to hear from the students every week because it's an intensive 6-credit class. And so that was your influence of doing reaction papers, which I've used before in some classes.
Sure.
But I remember, you know, my professors are always influential. I mean, give you another example. Mm. When I was in graduate school, you know, the understanding was unless you really screwed up, you got an A. Grades were not particularly pertinent in graduate school. So when I'm teaching this class now, and I gave back the first set of papers, I said, I'm not putting any letter grades on these because I'm assuming everyone is doing quality work. And if there's a problem, I'll let you know. But we're in graduate school, feel these are peers. These are people who are working professionals in higher ed. And they're doing this as a weekend program. And so that was something that my faculty, my professors taught me. And I always, you know, when I teach, I often realize that I'm just embodying the voice of a faculty member or two that I've had in the past. And I think a lot about experience at New Paltz and graduate school. And writing to you was part of my feeling that faculty need to know, professors need to know how they've impacted on their students many, many years later. And So when I signed reaction papers, I'm going to look Alan Shartok up, and that's where I discovered you. And I said, I need to write him a note, because I just feel it's, you know, as a student, you want to give back to the faculty that have influenced your life.
So nice. Sexism. Obviously, the relationships in colleges, both among the student body in terms of faculty, was that challenging to you at all?
Yeah, we were as clear as possible, certainly at Norwalk and at Bergen, that relationships between faculty and students were forbidden. You know, any kind of violations there, any examples of any even appearance of any harassment or complaint was taken quite seriously. And not that, you know, I think, you know, dealing with the Title IX infractions has been very difficult. But fortunately, one of the things I did when I was at Norwalk, I hired a phenomenal woman who's now succeeded me. She was my diversity and inclusion, the chief diversity and inclusion officer at the college, and then became my chief operating officer. And I hired this person to really oversee issues of sexual harassment, discrimination, really provide a venue for people, someone to come to who, and she herself is a lawyer, but was able to adjudicate situations. So I think those are really important issues. And there is that, of course, power dynamic that exists between faculty and student that has to be understood and, in my feeling, not jeopardized.
So let's talk a little bit about the criteria for promotion that you believe in. Obviously, being in rank long enough and harness long enough is not good enough for you. On the other hand, you know, the Academy has always been interesting in that if you write a book, for example, it has outsized importance, whereas if you're a great teacher, not always. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, no, I feel that teaching is critical. I mean, especially at an institution, you know, like a community college. I mean, you know, the teaching and reaching our students and being able to have good high standards, but also being sensitive to students and trying to focus on teaching that's going to allow our students to succeed and, importantly, to complete, whether it be a course, a program, or a degree, is really critical. So teaching to me is essential. And in that environment, for me as a president, certainly the number one attribute that I looked for. And teaching, and also to evaluate teaching in a triangulated way, meaning that, you know, it's not just observations that, you know, department chairs do. It's not just student evaluations, but to look at a composite set of indicators that would allow you to judge on the effectiveness of an instructor. And also, to me, very important to have an evaluation process that nurtures people. I think everyone always needs continual professional development to feel revitalized. And we tried, and very important, to do what I consider a formative evaluation process where, you know, if there were issues someone was encountering, there would be a peer that would help, or there would be, at Norwalk, we have a very active Center for Teaching and Learning. So they would, you know, help with an instructor. And so if someone was not as effective as she or he should have been at the outset, I certainly would give people a chance. But when it came time, certainly for tenure, I wanted to make sure that, you know, we had an effective teacher and also someone who was involved in community service. And community service, you know, certainly community-based organizations would be important too, but I wanted to see them, their involvement at the college, because, you know, one of the beauties of higher ed is the peer-led nature of that. So it's not just sitting on a committee or just going through the pro forma obligations, but really making a contribution to the community. Because, you know, especially with faculty and with the lack of funding for having certainly the number of full-time faculty that I would have desired at the college, our faculty positions are really precious, and we want to make sure whomever we tenure is going to really be a lifelong contributor.
You really put your finger on this business about adjuncts versus full-time faculty. There's been a lot of criticism for too many adjuncts.
Yeah.
Do you feel that?
To some extent, yes. You know, I think adjuncts provide a lot of vitality. The irony is I'm an adjunct professor now in Johnson & Wales doctoral program in higher education. And, you know, I'm considered an adjunct there because I'm a professor of practice. And so I think I have something to contribute. At the same time, you know, as an adjunct, I feel welcome to make contributions in my current role. But it's really the time, and as not being a full-time professor and having really what is a full-time fellowship obligation, I always feel, you know, can I really put in the hours and the time necessary to provide the support? And there are times that I have to make a decision that, you know, I really can't spend more time preparing for X class. I need to do, you know, another part of my full-time responsibilities. It becomes a struggle for me internally, quite honestly. But also at a larger institutional level, you know, you want to have full-time faculty who are present and hopefully present physically, but certainly also virtually, who can really advise and counsel students and to create the kind of one-to-one relationships that are really transformative for people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. College costs a lot of money, even community colleges in some states and places. Should community colleges be free?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you asked that because in Connecticut, we're dealing with legislation that was passed in the 11th hour creating free community colleges. It was, you'll appreciate this, it was, I think, on page 520 of a budget that was passed. So it was one of the euphemistic buried things that came out. And, you know, I think everyone should have the wherewithal, the support to go to college. The free part, I get a little bit concerned because I think it's important for everyone to have, quote, some skin in the game. And I think that that does make a world of difference. On the other hand, you know, for an earnest student or anyone who, you know, wishes to improve their lives, I feel there should be resources there. So I can't say I'm blanketly for free community college. I think that we should make that as accessible, or college as accessible as possible. But, you know, to be universalistic like that. And also, you know, the other irony is to have no income limits. You know, the idea of course, providing free higher education to those who can at times more than afford a community college tuition is also, I find, a bit problematic.
You know, when I went to Hunter College in the Bronx back in the day, which is now Lehman right. College, it was free. And right. I tell you, I would see people who never, if you had charged them $100, could right. have gone to college. So I think the other side of skin in the game is some people have sure. no skin.
Right. No, that's true. And having no skin is no shame in that either. You know, I think the issue for me becomes someone who's got a lot of capabilities to pay and not. You know, I think it's a fine balance. And also, of course, Hunter at that time, you know, had very competitive admission standards.
You bet.
And, you know, again, I'm not
85 average, you didn't go.
Right. No, I think people should get an opportunity. I think what gets me concerned is kind of this blanket, you know, provision that, again, some who might not need that could take advantage of it. And in that way, utilize resources that might be better spent than someone who didn't have a skin, so to speak.
Do people look down their noses at community colleges? And if they do, what's the way out of that?
Very much so, yeah. Especially, I think, in the Northeast, you know, people, they look at community college as being, you know, a 13th grade, an extension of high school. You know, often faculty in community colleges are viewed as second rate. And, you know, I've been very involved with the American Sociology Association. I co-chaired a community college faculty task force where we did some really interesting national work looking at the conditions for community college sociologists and did a number of things to try to bolster their status in the profession. So I think it's very much still a problem. And, you know, I know that being labeled as a community college faculty member, and for that matter, community college president, I often felt that I was put on the bottom tier. So I think it is a real problem. And I think, you know, in many ways, it becomes a larger issue of what do we mean by a meritocracy in our society. And, you know, when people look at community colleges and look at them as being, quote, open admissions, often the status or stature is deprecated. And also teaching in one. I know that, you know, my mentors, when I told them I was going to be teaching in a community college, they were not overjoyed in graduate school. And I think now they, you know, respect what I've done as a president and whatever. But there still very much is that stratification in terms of status and prestige. And I think it's very unfortunate.
So, David Levinson, so let's say you're at a cocktail party and you're talking to somebody from a major four-year graduate institution and they look down their nose at you. What do you do?
What I would do would be to
punch them in the nose.
Well, punch them in the nose, of course, but beyond that, let me tell you about my students.
What I love to do is
tell about these students, many of whom are there with such struggles. Having students who would sleep in class because they were up all night working at a local hospital, or a student who was not coming to class because he needed to be home to translate things for his Spanish-speaking mother. You know, I would tell them the struggles that people go through, people who are hungry. I've had students who are homeless, many students who are undocumented. And, you know, I think, you know, if people understand the struggles that people go through and yet their ability to achieve, and also, you know, as a faculty member, how much their experience is live in the classroom. Those are some of the things I would mention, and also say that depending upon the individual, many of his or her students may have originated from a community college anyway. So I think it's the issue is, you know, what is your role as a teacher? What is your belief in what I could euphemistically define as social justice? And if you are a good, well-meaning, liberal college professor, why are you turning your noses down to these people?
We are talking to Dr. David Levinson, the inaugural Presidential Fellow for the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities. Well, David, you have a particular student who had a story that you want to tell us about.
Oh, wow. There's one student that comes to mind. This is a student who actually was the head of student government at Norwalk, who also ended up being interested in sociology, someone who is undocumented. And this student was just a phenomenal student, and he was admitted to Cornell University. He had finished his degree at Norwalk, got into Cornell University as a sociology major, because I was thrilled. But he couldn't attend because as an undocumented student, he was not eligible for any federal financial aid, and the university would not give him any money. So lo and behold, I knew someone who was on the board of trustees of Cornell University at the time, and this individual was kindly to provide entree for me to speak with the president of Cornell University. And so I remember speaking with the president of Cornell, talking about the student, telling the president how wonderful he was and how we are so honored that he would be admitted and whatnot. And the president of Cornell at the time, and I forget actually his name, basically said to me over the phone, well, he's clearly a great student, but we've given out all of our financial aid for international students, and we can't subsidize his tuition or living costs. And, you know, speaking of punching someone in the nose, I wanted to say, with your endowment at Cornell University, you can't provide a scholarship. So to make a long story short, the student did not get admitted to Cornell. He went to the University of Connecticut in Stamford, a local branch of the university. And to his credit, he then went ahead and he created an organization called Connecticut Students for a Dream. And I have the honor of serving on the board of that organization. And this individual, his name is Lucas, has done an incredible job creating an amazing organization that was able to get the Connecticut State Legislature just last year to allow undocumented students to access state financial aid. And I'm so proud of him. And this is just, you know, an amazing person, amazing story, an individual who enriched my life and has enriched the lives of countless students in Connecticut.
Well, Dr. David Levinson, I guess I don't want to ask this question to a sociologist, particularly a left-wing sociologist. But do you ever think that there is a guiding hand of some kind that makes something like that? You get turned down at Cornell, you go to a place that has a lesser reputation but still is important, and you end up as a very important person. Do you ever think, boy, how does that happen?
I don't know. That's actually a very good question, because I'm also a part of a humanistic Judaism congregation. And I've been part of the Society for Humanistic Judaism for quite some time. So it's a good question you're asking. I'm really not sure. I think there is something else there. I'm not sure what that else is, you know, whether it's some level of fate or some, you know, higher being or higher force. But I struggle with that, and I really don't have a good answer.
Dr. David Levinson, let me ask you this. Suppose I ask you what you would like to have done over if you had a chance. Is there something that you think you may have missed or that you should have done?
Yeah, the one thing that I would have liked to have done over was this is relatively small, but I'd finished my dissertation and I was presenting some part of the work at the American Sociology Association.
Right.
And afterwards, someone came up to me from the Boston Globe and he said, you know, we would be very interested in publishing part of that as the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. And like a snotty graduate student, I said, ah, not good enough. I don't want to be. I want a book out of this or something else. And it's something that taught me to be a little bit more appreciative and modest, because at the time I can't believe I was so obnoxious and said that. And then, of course, tried to send my dissertation out for publication and was told by one publisher, you know, it's a good dissertation, but that's it. And then another publisher said, yeah, we'll publish it, but you need to give us $2,000 as a subvention to help subsidize it. And after going through all of that, I realized, gee, I could have had influence on the public at large, and yet I thought that wasn't prestigious enough. So that's one thing that I think about.
So our anger sometimes gets in the way. I certainly know that from my own thing. You know, if you just don't fall for it, if you just don't do that, I mean, philosophically, I have to tell you, I've tried to learn that over the years, and here I am at 78 years old, and believe me, I'm still trying to learn it.
Well, it keeps you going. It's good. We can't figure everything out.
it does. Well, yeah. You're 65. You have a future. What is your future?
Yeah, what I'd like to do is I'm really enjoying teaching. I'd like to join an institution really as a professor of practice. I enjoy teaching in higher education because I can use and I have utilized some of my sociological background. And I think that's what I'd like to do. And now also I'd love to do some more writing. You know, I haven't had a chance to really do that much as a president, so I like to do that. And I like to, you know, just, you know, reemerge as a student also. I have a luxurious situation this year. I'm doing work for our system office of the 17 colleges and universities. I have one office in Hartford in our system office, but also I'm spending a lot of time at Western Connecticut State University in Danbury, where my good friend is president. And I'm just loving absorbing all these things, you know, being at a new university office-wise, teaching at another university I didn't know of until just a few months ago, and then being involved still in Hartford and the political struggles of a underfunded university system. So I feel very blessed, to say the least, if I can say that as a humanist.
And we feel blessed to have had you with us today, Dr. David Levinson. I want to thank you for writing me a note. As soon as I heard a bit of your story, I said, we got to talk to this guy on the air. You are, of course, the inaugural president for the Connecticut State Colleges and Universities. Hey, David. Thank you so much for all you've given us today.
Thank you, Alan, for this opportunity. So well appreciated.